I want to try a little experiment with you. Wherever you are right now, unless you're driving, please keep your eyes on the road. But if you can, just close your eyes for a second. Take a breath. Now I'm going to say a single word, and I want you to catch the very first image that flashes onto the movie screen of your mind. Don't filter it. Don't try to be clever. Just catch the raw visual. The word is war. Okay, open them. Now, I'm willing to bet my next paycheck that I know exactly what you saw.
I think I know too.
You saw tanks rolling over a muddy hill, right? Kicking up dust. You saw trenches in Europe, maybe from a black and white documentary you saw in history class.
Fighter jets, you probably saw fighter jets screaming overhead.
Yeah, fighter jets, maybe a mushroom cloud rising in the distance, or soldiers in camouflage kicking down a door. You saw explosions, you saw bodies. Essentially, you saw one group of people using heavy machinery to physically destroy another group of people.
That is the universal default. It is, the stock footage we all have stored in our brains. It's almost Jungian at this point. It's the collective unconscious idea of what war is.
Exactly. It's instant. It's visceral. And that is exactly where we have to start today.
Yeah.
Because what if I told you that image isn't actually a definition of war? What if I told you that image is just one specific and frankly pathological way of waging war that we've all been conditioned to think is the only way?
It's like thinking the only way to cook food is with a flamethrower.
Right.
I mean, it's an effective tool for applying heat, but
You lose all the
you
nuance.
lose all the nuance and you probably burn down the kitchen.
Yeah.
A hidden assumption that completely dictates how we see the world, how we spend our tax dollars, and how we, how we define safety itself.
Today, we are going to completely dismantle that assumption. We are taking a deep dive into a text that, and I'm not exaggerating here, it really shook my worldview. It's a dense, heavy piece called Understanding War, a Philosophical Inquiry by John McMurtry.
This is a truly fascinating piece of work. It was published back in 1989 by Science for Peace. And for context, you really have to put yourself in 1989. It's crucial. We're at the absolute tail end of the Cold War. The Berlin Wall is about to come down. The entire world is pivoting.
Everything is up in the air.
Everything. But this isn't your standard Tom Clancy military history. It's not about, flanking maneuvers or how many tons of TNT were dropped on Dresden.
No, it's not a history book at all. It feels more like a diagnostic manual for a sick patient.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
It really is. It is a rigorous philosophical breakdown of the logic, or as McMurtry might argue, the madness of the military machine itself. His peers have called it a crystalline critique and a groundbreaking investigation into the deep structure of war making.
Crystalline critique. I like that. It sounds sharp. And honestly, reading through this, it felt sharp. It cuts right through the noise of what we usually hear on the news about, troop movements and strategy.
It goes a layer deeper.
Way deeper. So the mission for this deep dive is pretty ambitious. We are going to try to dismantle the superstitions that surround the idea of national defense. We're going to look at McMurtry's central argument that the very things we think protect us, our massive armies, our nuclear stockpiles, the trillions of dollars in defense spending, might actually be the biggest enemies of our survival.
It is a provocative stance. I mean, it sounds almost counterintuitive to everything we're taught in civics class.
Right. It's the opposite of peace through strength.
Exactly. But McMurtry builds his case very methodically. He's not just making a wild claim. He starts with a simple, bothering question. Why do we wage war on cancer to save lives, but we wage military war to destroy them, and yet we use the same word war for both activities?
That distinction right there is the aha moment we're going to work toward, because if you can really get your head around that question, you understand his whole argument.
It's the skeleton key.
It is. So, to keep us on track, because this gets deep fast, here's the roadmap for this deep dive. First, we are going to deconstruct what McMurtry calls the military paradigm, basically, the mental trap we are all stuck in.
Yeah.
Then, second, we're going to look at the tribal a priori. That sounds fancy, but it's basically the logic error we all make when we look at our side versus their side. Then we will move into the philosophical core of the argument, the distinction between the agent and the pattern. This is the tool that lets you, have enemies without being a murderer.
Agreed. A crucial distinction. Then, naturally, we follow the money. We're going to look at the economics of war, why it pays to keep fighting, even when it makes no sense strategically.
And finally, we'll look at the alternatives. How do you win a war without firing a shot? It's a journey from the diagnosis of a pathologer to a prescription for a different kind of health. I love that. So let's jump right in. Section one, the problem with the military paradigm. We establish that when we think of war, we think of killing organized mass homicide. McMurtry calls this a pathological reduction. Break that down for us. What does he mean by reduction here?
Well, think about the word. To reduce something is to shrink it, to strip away its nuance, its complexity. McMurtry argues that war, in its truest, broadest sense, is simply a struggle to overcome resistance. That's it.
A struggle to overcome resistance.
Yes. It is a mobilized, organized effort to defeat something that is threatening you. That's the core definition.
Okay, so if I'm struggling to get my toddler to eat peas, is that a war? I mean, it feels like one sometimes.
Yeah. In a philosophical sense, yes, a very tiny one. You are mobilizing ever persuasion, airplane noises, whatever, to overcome resistance to achieve a goal, which is nutrition. But let's look at more serious examples he uses.
Right.
You trying to lose 20 pounds is a war on obesity. Scientists trying to eradicate smallpox is a war on disease. In those cases, the goal is to remove a threat to life, to enhance life.
The resistance is the disease, and the goal is health.
Exactly. But the military paradigm has hijacked the word. It has convinced us that war necessarily and only means organized armed engagement, seeking to kill or mutilate large numbers of human beings. We've taken this broad, useful concept and reduce it to its most brutal, life-destroying form.
It's the necessarily part that's the trap. We think, oh, we're at war. Okay, time to start killing people. It's like if you thought the only way to perform surgery was to amputate a limb.
Yes.
Sure, amputation is a type of surgery, but if you do it for a headache, you're a monster. You're not a doctor.
That is a very, very apt analogy. And McMurtry argues this is not just a semantic issue. It's not just about words. It's a moral disaster. We have accepted, without question, that the only way to solve a conflict between nations is to destroy the human beings on the other side. We conflate the problem with the people.
But wait, isn't that just human nature? I mean, I hear people say this all the time. Humans are violent. We've been killing each other since the caves. War is just what we do. You know, the whole killer ape theory, that we're hardwired for this.
That is the common wisdom, yes. It's the easy answer. We are taught that we are aggressive by nature. But here is where the research gets absolutely fascinating. And honestly, this was the most shocking part of the source material for me. McMurtry brings up a statistic from World War II that completely blows that theory out of the water.
This is the SLA Marshall data, right? From Men Against Fire.
Yes, exactly. Referring to the studies by Colonel S.A. Armstrong and SLA Marshall's famous book, they did these post-combat interviews with thousands of soldiers.
So set the scene for us. World War II, we're talking about the good war, the fight against pure evil. You picture intense combat, storming the beaches of Normandy, everyone firing their weapons, fighting for their lives and for freedom itself. What does the data actually say about what those men were doing?
The data says that among the men along the line of fire, during an engagement, so these are soldiers, with rifles, seeing the enemy, receiving incoming fire, only about 15 to 20% actually fired their weapons.
Hang on, 15%, that's what, 1 in 7 men? Maybe 1 in 5 at best.
At best.
Correct.
So what are the other guys doing? Are they just standing there?
Or they're firing over the enemy's head, or pretending their gun is jammed, or busy loading and fixing their weapon for an unusually long time. Marshall's team found that this held true whether the action lasted a day or 3 days, whether it was in Europe or the Pacific. The vast majority of soldiers, trained men with rifles in their hands, facing people who were trying to kill them, simply could not bring themselves to shoot back at another human being.
That is mind-bending. Because yeah. Hollywood, video games, everything tells us that when the adrenaline hits, the beast comes out, that the killer instinct takes over. But this suggests that when the chips are down, we actually have a deep, built-in hardwiring against killing each other.
Yep.
Exactly. It's a profound moral or psychological barrier. McMurtry emphasizes the joy of discovery in this fact. It suggests that humans aren't naturally mass killers. The report notes that each man who didn't fire thought he was the only one.
Oh, wow.
He thought he was a coward. He thought he was failing his country, his buddies next to him. But in reality, he was part of the silent majority who just couldn't cross that moral line of homicide.
It's almost tragic, isn't it? They felt guilty for not being murderers. The system made them feel ashamed of their own humanity.
It is deeply tragic. It shows that the military paradigm is not a reflection of who we are. It's an imposition on who we are. It's an artificial structure built to override our basic nature.
But this begs a huge question. If 85% of people naturally won't shoot, even to save their own lives, how do we have wars with millions of casualties? How do we get armies that do kill? Where do those numbers come from?
That is where the military paradigm comes in as a system of conditioning. Since humans won't naturally kill, the military has to break them to make them do it. This is why boot camp exists.
I always thought boot camp was just about doing push-ups and learning how to make a bed with perfect corners.
No, the physical training is secondary. That's for fitness and discipline. The primary goal is psychological reconstruction. You strip away their individuality, you shave their heads, you take away their names and give them numbers, you dress them alike, you scream at them until they are exhausted and their critical thinking shuts down.
It's about breaking them down to build them back up in a new image.
Exactly. You replace their internal moral compass with an external command structure based on fear and reflex. You drill them over and over on human-shaped targets until pulling the trigger is muscle memory, not a moral choice.
You turn a human being into a weapon or a component of a weapon.
You turn a subject, a thinking, feeling person with agency, into a predicate, an action of the state, a tool. You have to turn a human being into a gear and a machine so they will perform a function that they would never choose to perform on their own. The military isn't an expression of human nature. It's a system designed to overcome human nature.
That's a heavy reframing. We usually think of soldiers as the bravest of us, but this framework suggests they are the most conditioned of us, the ones whose natural instincts have been most successfully suppressed.
They're the ones who have been successfully reprogrammed to override what is arguably the strongest taboo in the human psyche, the prohibition against killing your own kind. And once you are in that system, once you have that programming, you fall into what McMurtry calls the all-or-nothing fallacy.
Okay, unpack that for us. What's the fallacy?
Because we are so conditioned by this military view, because it's the only tool we think we have, we start to think our only choices in a conflict are these two extremes. Either we engage in mass homicide, meaning military war, or we engage in total pacifism, which is framed as surrender or doing nothing.
It's nuke 'em or lay down and die. That's the only choice you're ever given on the news.
Exactly. And that is a false dichotomy. It's
yeah.
a lie. It blinds us to the thousands of other ways to wage conflict, economic, psychological, social, diplomatic. By thinking the only real war is a shooting war, we wipe all those other options off the table before we even start the conversation.
It's like having a toolbox with 1,000 precision instruments, lasers, scalpels, wrenches, screwdrivers, but you've convinced yourself that the only way to fix a leak is with a sledgehammer.
Right.
And if anyone says, hey, maybe don't use the sledgehammer on that copper pipe, you scream, oh, so you want the house to flood, you're on the side of the leak.
That is a perfect analogy. You're accused of not wanting to fix the leak just because you don't want to destroy the pipes in the process.
So we have this machine that forces us to kill. But how do we justify it to ourselves? How do we get the whole country on board? How do we sleep at night? That brings us to section two, the logic of madness. Or as McMurtry calls it, the tribal a priori.
This is where we get into the software that runs the hardware of war. The operating system of the military paradigm.
Tribal a priori. Let's unpack the jargon. A priori is philosophy speak for from the earlier. It means something you assume before you even look at the evidence, a starting point.
Right. If I say all bachelors are unmarried, I don't need to go interview every bachelor in the world to check if it's true. Mm-hmm. I know it by definition. The truth is contained within the statement. It's an a priori truth.
Okay, so it's a given. It's an unquestioned assumption. So what is the tribal a priori?
It is the foundational, unquestioned assumption that my side is good and moral, and the other side is the enemy and evil.
It's the team sports mentality applied to nuclear weapons. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys. End of story.
Essentially. But it's incredibly dangerous because it acts as a filter for reality. It is not based on evidence. You don't arrive at that conclusion after careful study. It is a preset bias. No matter what my side does, it is interpreted as defensive and necessary. No matter what their side does, it is interpreted as aggressive and diabolical.
So if we build a new missile system, it's for deterrence and stability. If they build the exact same missile system, it's an unprovoked aggression and a threat to world peace.
Precisely. The action is identical, but the moral interpretation is opposite, based on that a priori assumption about who is good and who is evil. And once you have that bias locked in, you fall into what McMurtry calls the lockstep sequence of military logic. It is a chain of reasoning that leads inevitably to death.
I want to walk through this chain because when you lay it out step by step, it sounds like a computer program for psychopaths. But you hear this exact logic on the news every single night.
Let's do it. It starts with the first assumption.
Step one, target T is hostile. Someone disagrees with us or wants something we have or is blocking our goals.
Therefore, step two, T is an enemy. The label is applied.
Therefore, step three, T is immoral. Because they are our enemy and we are good, they must be bad.
Therefore, step four, T must yield to us. Their position has no moral legitimacy, so they have to give in.
Therefore, step five, we must prevail. We have a moral obligation to win.
And the final step, therefore, step six, we must destroy T.
It feels like a slippery slope, but in the military paradigm, it's treated as absolute ironclad logic. If you are hostile, you are an enemy. If you are an enemy, you are bad. If you are bad, I have to kill you. There are no other options.
And notice the hidden jumps there, the fallacies. Just because someone is hostile or holds a different view, why does that make them immoral? And more importantly, why does prevailing necessarily mean destroying them?
Right. Why can't we prevail by converting them or ignoring them or trading with them so our interests align or, you know, just outcompeting them?
Those options are erased by the lockstep logic. The only form of prevailing allowed is physical annihilation.
McMurtry has a great quote about this. He says, if an individual person thought this way, like, let's say I have a neighbor, Bob, and Bob plays his music too loud. So Bob is hostile.
Okay.
Therefore, Bob is an enemy. Therefore, Bob is evil. Therefore, Bob must yield. Therefore, I must prevail. Therefore, I must destroy Bob. So I burn Bob's house down.
We would lock you up. Immediately. We would call it systematically and criminally insane. We would see it as extreme paranoia, as a complete inability to deal with minor conflict in a rational way.
But when a nation does it, when a nation says they are a threat to our interests, therefore they are evil, therefore we must bomb them, we call it strategic necessity or national security. We normalize the pathological just because it's happening on a geopolitical scale.
We give it a fancy name and salute it. And this ties into that concept of the zero-sum game mentioned in the foreword of the text.
Explain that. What is a zero-sum game?
The zero-sum game is the belief that the pie is fixed. There is a limited amount of security or power or resources in the world. So for me to win, you must lose. My security depends on your insecurity. My strength depends on your weakness. Any gain for you is, by definition, a loss for me.
Which is a miserable way to live, if you think about it. It guarantees permanent conflict. You can never truly relax because your safety requires someone else to be suffering or weak.
It does. It makes cooperation look like treason. And it stops us from asking the most fundamental question of all, the one that underpins this entire disaster.
Which is?
Who is the self we are trying to defend?
This is section three of our roadmap, and honestly, this is the part where the philosophy really hits the road. We always hear about self-defense, national self-defense. It's the ultimate trump card in any argument. No one can argue against self-defense. But McMurtry asks, who or what is the self?
It sounds like a simple question. If the U.S. or Canada or France claims self-defense, surely they're defending their people, the population, their citizens.
That's what we assume. We assume the nation equals the citizens. Like the government is just a big homeowners association for all of us looking out for our collective interests. But McMurtry breaks this down into layers. He says, okay, let's test that. Is the self the biological bodies of the citizens?
If it were, if the primary goal of national defense was to keep the maximum number of citizens alive and unharmed, then war would be the worst possible way to defend it.
Right. It would be a catastrophic failure by definition.
Because what is the first thing that happens in war? The biological bodies of citizens are destroyed. You send your young men to die on the front lines. You expose your cities and your families to bombing. You create refugees. You destroy health systems. If the goal is keeping citizens alive, war is a failure from the moment it begins.
So it can't be just the biological self. What about the commercial self? Is that what we're defending? Meaning the markets, the trade routes, the corporations?
Often, yes. The source argues this is a much more common self that's being defended than we'd like to admit.
Or is it the ideological self, like democracy or communism or the American way of life, these abstract concepts?
Which is also a powerful motivator.
Yeah.
Or finally, is it the warrior self, these even more abstract concepts of national honor and glory and prestige? We can't let them disrespect us.
Mm.
We have to maintain our credibility.
The text makes a really cynical, but I think vital point here. Often when a government says national interest, they aren't talking about your interest or my interest as citizens. They are talking about the private interest of a ruling group.
McMurtry argues that ruling groups use the language of defense as pretext. The self they're defending is very often their access to foreign resources, cheap labor pools, or crucial investment markets.
Can you give us an example?
Think about the banana republics in the early 20th century. The U.S. Marines weren't sent to Honduras or Guatemala to protect the homes of people in Ohio from an imminent invasion. They were sent to protect the land holdings and the profit margins of the United Fruit Company.
So when we send 18-year-olds to die in a jungle thousands of miles away, we aren't defending their homes from invasion. We might be defending a fruit company's quarterly earnings report.
That is the commercial self, masquerading as the national self. And there is a profound and tragic contradiction there. The citizens pay what McMurtry calls the blood tax. They die. Their families grieve. They pay the financial costs through their taxes. But the benefit goes to the commercial self of a tiny elite.
So the civilian body and the ruling body actually have opposite interests. The civilian wants to live, eat, and be safe. The ruling body wants to expand, control, and profit, even if it costs civilian lives.
Precisely. The ruling body, in this framework, treats the citizens as a resource, as raw material fuel to be spent in the engine of economic or territorial expansion.
And this explains what McMurtry calls the defensive invasion, which just sounds like an oxymoron. It's like jumbo shrimp or peacekeeper missile. How can an invasion be defensive?
It is the ultimate absurdity of this logic. A superpower invading a small, distant country, like the U.S. in Vietnam or the Soviets in Afghanistan, and calling it defense of our borders.
Yeah, how do you defend your border by crossing an ocean and attacking someone else's border? That seems geographically confused at a minimum.
You do it by manipulating the definition of self. If you define yourself to include your global interests, then anywhere your money is, your border is.
Yeah.
If you have an oil contract in the Middle East, that oil well becomes part of yourself. So if another country nationalizes that oil well, you can claim they have attacked yourself and you are justified in responding with self-defense.
That is terrifyingly clever. It expands the self until it covers the whole world, which means anyone, anywhere can be an enemy threat to yourself just by existing in a place you want to control.
And that leads us directly to the question of the enemy. If we've misunderstood the self, have we also misunderstood the enemy?
This is section 4. Agent versus pattern. And I think this is the most helpful tool McMurtry gives us. This is the part that I think can actually change how we handle conflict in our own lives, not just in geopolitics.
Right.
He goes back to the medical analogy he started with.
Yes. Let's look at how we wage war on smallpox or cancer. We say we are warring against these things, but what are we trying to destroy? Are we trying to destroy the cancer patient?
Of course not.
We are trying to destroy the threat, the disease, in order to save the life of the patient. The whole point is the preservation of life.
Right. You don't shoot a patient to cure their flu. That would be effective, I guess. The flu would be gone. But it's kind of missing the point of medicine.
The victory condition is a healthy patient, not a dead one. You attack the virus, the pattern of the disease, to save the agent, the human being who's carrying it.
But in military war, we do the exact opposite. We try to save the nation, which is an abstract idea, by destroying the people who are real biological agents.
We destroy the human beings to save the structure. It's completely backwards.
Yeah.
And this is where McMurtry introduces the key philosophical distinction of the whole text. The agent versus the pattern.
Break that down for us. This is critical.
Okay. The agent is the human being, the person, the breathing, thinking, feeling, biological reality. The pattern is the ideology, the structure, the disease, or the behavior they are enacting. It's the software they are running.
So if we look at WWII again, the Nazi soldier is the agent, and Nazism, the ideology of fascism, the racism, the aggression, is the pattern.
Correct. McMurtry argues that the true enemy is the pattern. It is Nazism or militarism or imperialism that we need to destroy. We do not necessarily need to physically liquidate the human being, the conscript, the agent, who is forced to bear that pattern.
Because that soldier in the trench, he probably didn't invent Nazism. He might have been drafted. He might be terrified. He is a carrier of the disease, but he is not the disease itself.
Exactly. He is infected with the pattern. And this is a radical critique of traditional ethics. You have famous philosophers like Thomas Nagel or Elizabeth Anscombe who write brilliant essays arguing about the rules of war. They debate things like it's moral to kill a soldier in uniform, but it's immoral to kill a civilian.
Right, the standard rules of engagement.
Yeah.
A soldier is a legitimate target and a civilian is not.
But McMurtry says even that doesn't go deep enough. He asks, why is it moral to kill the combatant? Usually the combatant is just as much a victim of the pattern as the civilian. He is subject to conscription, coercion, propaganda. He didn't choose to be there any more than the civilian chose to live in a city that gets bombed.
So the true enemy isn't the 18-year-old holding the rifle. The true enemy is the structure of war that put the rifle in his hand in the first place.
Exactly. The structure is the disease. The soldier is just a symptom. If you kill the soldier but leave the structure of militarism in place, you haven't cured anything. You've just killed a man. and likely the structure will just draft another man to replace him tomorrow.
This really changes how you look at winning. Winning shouldn't mean a pile of dead bodies. Winning should mean the death of the hostility, the end of the pattern.
That is the medical model of victory. A doctor wins when the disease is gone and the patient is alive and healthy. A general wins when the enemy is dead. McMurtry suggests we need to adopt the medical model for geopolitics.
It's distinguishing the sinner from the sin, in a way. You attack the sin, not the sinner.
Very much so. It's a secular version of that very old spiritual truth. Focus on transforming the behavior, not eliminating the person.
But this begs the question, doesn't it? If the system is so insane, if it's so contrary to our nature, remember the 85% who won't shoot, and if it kills the people it's supposed to protect, why do we keep doing it? Why is the military paradigm so sticky? Why hasn't it collapsed under its own stupidity?
That brings us to Section 5, the political economy of militarization. And the answer, as is often the case when you see a deeply irrational system persisting for centuries, is one word: profit.
And power, but mostly profit.
McMurtry argues that armaments weapons are, from a purely economic standpoint, the perfect commodity for a capitalist economy.
The perfect commodity? That sounds dark. I mean, I love my smartphone. That's a great commodity. What makes a missile a better product than, say, a refrigerator or a smartphone?
Several hidden advantages that make investors drool. First, as we've noted, the per-unit price is astronomical. We are talking billions of dollars for a single weapon system, like a new fighter jet program or an aircraft carrier. You sell one of those, you've made a career, you've secured profits for a decade.
So the profit margins are huge.
Second, and this is key, rapid obsolescence.
Explain that.
If you buy a good refrigerator, it lasts 20 years. That's actually bad for business because you aren't buying another one for two decades. It's a one-time sale. But weapons, they're designed to be used literally they explode. Or even better from a business perspective, to become outdated without ever being used at all.
Ah, right. Oh, the other country has a new jet that can fly Mach 2.1. Well, our jets from last year that fly Mach 2.0 are now garbage. We need to buy 5,000 new ones.
Exactly. It creates an endless cycle of demand. Use it or it gets outdated. Either way, you must buy more. It's a consumer cycle that never ends, and it's fueled by fear, not need.
It's planned obsolescence on steroids, funded by tax dollars.
That is the third point. Capital financing. It is guaranteed by public taxes. There is no risk for the corporation. If a car company makes a terrible car, nobody buys it, and they might go bankrupt. If a defense contractor makes a plane that costs twice the budget and doesn't fly right, the government just pays them more money to fix it. There's no market discipline.
And because of national security, there is no real competition. It's a monopoly or an oligopoly. State secrets prevent anyone else from bidding. You can't have a startup in Silicon Valley decide to build a nuclear submarine in their garage and compete for the contract.
So you have a product with an astronomically high price, guaranteed demand fueled by fear, zero financial risk for the producer, and monopoly protection. From a pure business standpoint, it is perfection.
But McMurtry goes even deeper than just greedy defense contractors. He brings in a Marxian perspective. He says arms production is also a way for the state to manage economic crises.
Yes. It's a macroeconomic tool. It creates demand where there is none. If the economy is slumping, if people aren't buying cars or toasters because they're broke or worried about the future, the government can always pump billions of dollars into the economy by building tanks and missiles. It artificially props up the manufacturing sector and creates jobs.
It's a stimulus package that kills people.
That's a harsh but accurate way to put it, according to this analysis. And it's important to note, McMurtry is careful to point out this isn't just a capitalist problem. We have to be fair here and look at the whole picture he paints.
Right. He talks about the two blocks. The Soviet Union was doing the exact same thing during the Cold War.
The state socialist regimes used militarization to maintain centralized party command. It's the other side of the same coin. If you are always at war with the capitalist pigs, you have an excuse to crack down on dissent, to control the economy, to keep the population in line. Fear of an external enemy is a great way to manage a population and justify authoritarian control.
And here is the irony that I found really fascinating in the text. He says that capitalist militarism, which claims to be fighting communism and state control, actually creates a state socialist structure at home.
It is a profound irony. To fight the statists, the capitalist society moves massive amounts of private money, that's our taxes, into state control, the defense budget. The military-industrial complex is essentially a giant socialist program operating within a capitalist economy. It's central planning, government-funded, government-controlled, with guaranteed profits for a few private firms.
So we become the thing we claim to be fighting. We adopt their methods to oppose them.
In a structural sense, yes. The form of the economy begins to mirror the opponents. And this leads to the source's observation about the real threat.
Which is?
That the military-industrial complex of a nation often poses a greater threat to its own citizens' safety than the foreign enemy does.
Because it drains resources. Like, the money for schools and hospitals goes to bombs instead.
It drains resources? Absolutely. That's the opportunity cost. But it's more direct than that. It increases the risk of nuclear annihilation, which would kill everyone, not just the enemy. And it creates a culture of secrecy and surveillance at home, eroding civil liberties. McMurtry calls this universalizing military statism. The military program eventually swallows the civil society it claims to defend.
It's the immune system attacking the body, an autoimmune disease on a national scale. The white blood cells start eating the vital organs because they're programmed to see threats everywhere.
That is the perfect metaphor. The defenses have become the danger. The cure is worse than the disease.
So we've diagnosed the disease. The military paradigm is a trap. The logic is flawed. The economics are rigged. The self is a lie. What is the cure? How do we fight without becoming the monster?
This takes us to the final part of the argument, Section 6, Modes of War. McMurtry wants us to reclaim the word war and realize that it's a spectrum. It's not just one thing. There are different ways, different modes of overcoming resistance.
He lists a few different modes. Let's run through them to see the progression. First, there's the most brutal, genocide.
The biblical or ancient model. Think of Jericho in the Bible, or the destruction of Carthage by Rome. You destroy everything, men, women, children, cattle, buildings, you salt the earth, you wipe the slate clean. The goal is total negation of the other.
Then, a step up from that, there's subjugation.
This is the imperial model. You don't kill everyone because you realize dead people can't work for you. You keep them alive to use them. Slavery, colonialism. You want their labor, their land, their resources, so you break their will but spare their bodies. This is efficient war in a horrifyingly rational way.
And then there's the mode he advocates for, liberation.
This is the critical shift.
Yeah.
Liberation is a mode of war aimed at destroying the hostility to make a friend. It's the radical idea that you can conquer an enemy by turning them into an ally. The goal isn't a dead enemy, it's a new friend.
And this brings us to non-military warfare. Because if your goal is to overcome resistance, if it's to kill the hostility, not the person, you don't necessarily need bullets, you need better weapons.
And McMurtry points to the master of this, Gandhi in India. People often think of Gandhi as passive. They think nonviolence means weakness or not fighting. But Gandhi himself described his movement as a fight to the finish.
It was a war. He saw it as a war.
It was absolutely a war. It was strategized, mobilized, and required immense discipline and bravery. But it was a war against the pattern of British rule, not against the agents, the individual British people.
He didn't want to kill the British. He wanted to kill the idea that the British owned India.
And he won. He defeated the greatest empire on earth without an army. He won using strikes, boycotts, civil disobedience, ridicule, and what he called public shame.
Public shame as a weapon, that sounds, I don't know, soft compared to a machine gun. But McMurtry argues it's actually incredibly powerful.
It is. The text highlights that even the most brutal tyrants are sensitive to world opinion and public censure. Why? Because power is not just about force. It relies on legitimacy. Even a dictator needs people to obey him, both at home and abroad. If you strip away the legitimacy, if you make the tyrant look ridiculous or monstrous in the eyes of the world and his own people, their power base crumbles.
So information, culture, economics, refusal to cooperate, these are all powerful weapons in this different mode of war.
They are weapons that transform human agency rather than destroying it. You force the opponent to change their mind rather than blowing their brains out. You win by converting them, not killing them.
And this brings up the comparison he makes between Sun Tzu and Clausewitz. We hear these names thrown around in business schools, but the contrast here in the text is really sharp and important.
It's fundamental. Clausewitz is the Western military godfather, the Prussian general. He defined war as an act of violence intended to compel our opponent to fulfill our will. It is about force, domination, crushing the other into submission.
And Sun Tzu?
Sun Tzu, the ancient Chinese strategist, argued that the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. He said the greatest victory is that which requires no battle. He recommended inflicting the fewest possible casualties. If you destroy the city you want to capture, you've gained nothing but rubble.
So one guy says, smash them until they obey, and the other says, outsmart them until they agree with you.
Essentially. And the tragedy, McMurtry points out, is that while we have the technology to destroy the world, the ultimate Clausewitzian tool, we are stuck in what he calls a killer gang mentality. We have 21st century weapons, but Stone Age social software.
Killer gang mentality. That's a humbling way to describe modern superpowers with nuclear arsenals.
It is meant to be. It highlights that for all our sophistication, for all our talk of strategy and geopolitics, we are still acting like tribes throwing rocks at each other. We just have much, much bigger rocks now.
So as we wrap this up, let's reframe the narrative. We started this episode asking what war is, and the first image we all had was of killing.
Right. And what we've seen is that we've been duped into thinking war equals killing. We've seen that the military paradigm is a specific chosen structure, not a law of nature. It uses a false logic, the tribal a priori, to justify atrocities.
And it serves the commercial interests of a powerful elite while sacrificing the lives of the very citizens it claims to protect.
And most importantly, we've learned that the true enemy might not be the country across the ocean. The true enemy is the structure of violence itself, the pattern of militarism that infects all sides.
The shift McMurtry wants us to make is massive. It is moving from defining national security as kill capacity, how many people can we kill per minute, to defining it as social and economic health.
Because if your people are healthy, fed, educated, and free, that is a secure nation. That is a strong nation, no matter how many tanks you have.
Your strength comes from the well-being of your people, not the size of your arsenal.
Precisely. The text notes that countries like Canada or Finland aren't safe because they can beat the U.S. or Russia in a fight. That's absurd. They are safe because of a complex web of non-military factors. Diplomacy, economic integration, shared civil values. They rely on civilian defense, not just military defense.
So here is the final provocation for you listening. McMurtry leaves us with this thought. The lines of life and death that define who is us and who is them, they're drawn by us. They aren't drawn by nature.
Nature doesn't say, this side of the river is good, that side is evil. We say that. We invent those lines.
And if we draw the lines, we have the freedom and maybe the responsibility to redraw them.
Mm-hmm.
So the question to leave you with is this. If the real enemy is the structure of violence, how do you fight that war in your daily life?
How do you fight the tribal a priori in your own head? When you see a conflict on the news or even at work or in your family, do you immediately jump to, I'm good, they're evil, I must destroy them? Or do you try to look for the pattern, for the misunderstanding or the structure that is causing the conflict?
Do you attack the agent or do you try to cure the pattern?
It is a difficult shift to make. It requires fighting that warrior instinct that our culture has implanted in us for generations. But McMurtry suggests it is the only way we survive as a species in a nuclear age.
We have to stop being warriors against people and start being warriors against the idea of war itself.
A war against war. It sounds like a paradox, but when you break it down like this, it might be the only logical path left.
This has been a heavy one, but an important one. I want to thank you for taking this deep dive with us.
It is always a pleasure to unpack these big, difficult ideas.
Remember, the goal here isn't just to know more stuff. It's to see the invisible structures around us, to question the things we take for granted, like what the word war really means.
Because knowledge is the first step to redrawing those lines for yourself.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next deep dive. Stay curious.